You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on September 8th, 2013 from our studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, Persephone and I discuss Russia versus the UK on the world stage, international cooperation on global pollutants, and a new push to restrict freedom of choice in the United States. All this is just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, joining me for one final episode before she goes to another country for however long is my co-host Persephone, joining me here in studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Persephone, thank you for doing one final episode.
You're very welcome, and I'm so glad that I'm going to be able to say goodbye.
I feel like you're saying that you really don't want to do the show with me anymore.
It's been such a wonderful experience.
You're glad to have the chance to say goodbye, or you're glad to be leaving?
I'm glad to have the opportunity to say goodbye before I leave and have one last show for old time's sake.
Yeah, it's always good when we can have a final farewell from our regular co-hosts so that they don't disappear suddenly like a character from 1984. So what briefly are you going to be doing, roughly?
I'm going to be getting a master's degree in political science at the University of Liège.
And that's in Belgium?
It is in Belgium.
Okay. And what is your general field that you're going to be pursuing the studies in?
I'm going to be studying languages and nationalism and national identity.
Well, you know, languages and nationalism are a favorite topic of Arsenal for Democracy. It's going to be unfortunate that we won't be able to have you commentating on some of this. But why don't we start off with a display of nationalism in the news this past week. The G20 summit of the top 20, well, 19 economies plus the European Union met in Moscow for this, you know, they host it annually in a different country every year, and this time it was Russia's turn to host, and Russia decided to take the opportunity to mock the United Kingdom. Why don't you introduce that story for us, Persephone?
So basically what happened is that Russia decided to sort of throw its weight around in the form of Dmitry Peskov, who is the spokesman for Putin, to say that the UK is basically, quote, just a small island. No one pays any attention to them. So clearly a personal and unwarranted attack on the UK.
Yeah, and of course partly in response to the fact that the UK Parliament had unexpectedly voted against military action in Syria, and therefore David Cameron was feeling a little bit sensitive. He didn't react very well to this comment.
No, he didn't. And he very vehemently rejected it, saying that he didn't accept it for a moment, saying also using it as an opportunity to push for an intervention in Syria. And saying that Britain will be, quote, leading the argument across the globe for continuing to respond strongly on chemical weapons. So really using this, I mean, that's part of why I think Russia made the comment, is as a sort of, you know, because they're, you know, clearly
Russia's the main blocking force that's been preventing much action from happening.
Yeah, so it was really, you know, the diplomatic equivalent of, you know, na 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 na.
Yeah, so I feel like, okay, the United Kingdom has been kind of somewhat irrelevant since a lot of the decolonization effort happened. Like, you know, and for a while they just kind of accepted that, and then Thatcher being all rah-rah nationalist, you know, and they had the Falklands-Malvinas War, and that, you know, was a quote-unquote victory. And so then, you know, the people started having, oh, we've still got this national military power, blah, blah, blah. We can continue to expand our military, have a big role. And they participated in, you know, your Gulf War, your next Iraq War, your war in Afghanistan, your conflict in Libya, so on and so forth. And so Britain really, you know, flexing its muscles. And we see France doing the same thing as a post-colonial power, doing its intervention in Mali that we talked about extensively here on Arsenal for Democracy. I see where the argument is being made that, you know, those are relatively limited things. It's not like the United States couldn't have done those operations without British help. Those were more for like diplomatic backing and being able to say, hey, we're not doing this alone. We've got this other partner that's working on it. And so, you know, was Britain technically necessary for those things? No, not entirely. So in that respect, the Russian argument that Britain is somewhat uninfluential and kind of irrelevant, you can see where that's coming from. But I don't think Russia is exactly the messenger to be delivering that message, because Russia is pretty irrelevant to a lot of things. They're obviously, they're part of the G8, which has been increasingly made irrelevant by the G20. That really waters down their influence. They were only part of the G8 because out of kind of pity, because they had nuclear weapons and stuff. So even though they were, you know, arguably there were a whole lot of economies that should have been in ahead, they expanded the G7 to include Russia because, you know, let's just throw Russia a bone after their complete economic meltdown in the 1990s. But then, you know, and then they did have that period of sort of economic revival, so to speak, in the sort of mid years of the Putin regime. And that was mostly oil and gas and that sort of thing. That ends up being a good revenue stream. And then the price of oil starts coming down around the end of 2008. That becomes less important. And it really highlights the fundamental weaknesses of the Russian economy, which are that it's heavily dependent on oil and gas and other mineral wealth, natural resource extraction, and there's not a lot to be said for it going on otherwise. You know, they have pretty high unemployment, I think, on a general basis. There's not a lot of, you know, entrepreneurialism going on, not a lot of other businesses. I don't think they have much of a financial sector, not that that's necessarily a problem per se, but it's a metric of how like developed and stable your economy is and how diverse it is, because otherwise you just have commodities trading and stuff, and they don't have, you know, there's the corporations, there's a few big mega corporations, they're not very transparent or anything, and they just mostly are focused on these oil and gas things. They've been just kind of mismanaged and a mess, and they've been too reliant on this mineral wealth. You've also got those other statistics like super high mortality rates, and they have, you know, the average life expectancy for men in Russia is still like in the mid 60s, whereas the rest of the, you know, like the advanced world at least is, you know, got up in the upper 70s and into the 80s in some cases, in high 80s in like Japan's case, I believe. So really not a lot going for Russia at this point. They're, you know, they have nuclear weapons, so you got to pay attention to them for that. They, you know, used to be the Soviet Union, you got to pay attention for that. They do have a lot of mineral wealth, so you can't completely discount that. And most importantly, as we've seen with the Syria situation, they've got a veto at the UN Security Council. They're a permanent member. They're one of the five with a veto. That means that even if every other member of the Security Council votes for something, they can veto it and block stuff. So that means that Russia has basically the same level of influence that Britain does, which is that it can block something from happening. But I would argue that Britain still has some influences in a way that Russia doesn't. You can look at the intervention in 2000 in Sierra Leone. That was British-led. They were there to, I think, relieve a UN mission that was being completely overrun at that point. They just kind of decided they were going to go in, stop this humanitarian crisis from developing, stop the fighting, end the civil war, set up a, you know, transition to a new government, etc. They pretty much did that. That was a pretty big success. And yeah, that was 13 years ago, but that was still something that they did. And that is what I would refer to as, you know, it moves the world forward. If you veto something at the UN Security Council, you're not moving it back necessarily, but you are preventing something from happening in the future that is a, you know, positive development. You want things to be moving forward, presumably. I think at any rate that should be a goal. I don't know you know, if you would agree with that sentiment. But I think that you want to be, if you want to influence world events, your goal should be to influence them positively and in a forward moving direction. You can make the case that, well, these are relatively small examples. They're in West Africa or whatever. They're small countries with, you know, relative to, say, some of the other countries like Nigeria. Nobody's intervening there in some of the civil conflicts that have happened and continue to happen there. But at the end of the day, it matters to those people. It matters in terms of stabilizing some of these conflicts that have gone on for a really long time. The Sierra Leone situation had been going on for a long time. And Britain finally said, look, enough is enough. We're going in, we're going to sort this out, and we're going to get it done. And, you know, they provided a valuable service that helped at least that part of the world. And it, to my mind, that is positively influencing events in a forward direction. And that's not something that Russia has done. Russia's, like, only peacekeeping stuff has been in former Soviet areas. And sometimes they're not even invited. They just show up and say, oh, we're peacekeepers now. And that's how you end up with, like, the 2008 Russia-Georgia war, because Georgia's upset that there's continued Russian presences and these, you know, sort of, quote, breakaway regions. And the Russian response to this has been to then worsen the situation by, like, recognizing the independence of those tiny breakaway things that can't possibly sustain themselves on their own. They've been thrown into these situations following the breakup of the Soviet Union. In many cases, they were just leftover troops that were there and couldn't get out. You know, in these situations in Armenia, Azerbaijan, Tajikistan, Moldova, these various places, and of course Georgia, as I mentioned, and they're nominally helping, but not really, because they didn't even have peacekeeping training. And we talked about this on the show a couple weeks ago about the value of peacekeeping, that there is a value to it, but it often doesn't work when it's led just by one country unilaterally and not through the United Nations. It's not, you know, and you start getting conflict of interest. Like, there's an obvious conflict of interest if a Russian peacekeeping force is protecting a Russian-speaking, ethnically Russian population in another country, which is often the case. And even, like, broader than that, there have been other things where they could have intervened and didn't. Let's take the example of Kyrgyzstan. A few years ago, 2010, Kyrgyzstan had a revolution in the early part of the year, in the spring, and then they had in the summer of 2010, started having what was termed acts of genocide. So basically, ethnic cleansing on a somewhat low-level scale of ethnically Uzbek citizens of Kyrgyzstan. And that becomes a problem because obviously you don't want people to be getting killed or whatever. And the U.S. could have probably intervened as well because they do have a U.S. airbase in Kyrgyzstan, or they did at the time. But they obviously didn't want to because that's Russia's so-called sphere of influence. And the only reason we had that airbase there was so we could maintain operations in Afghanistan. So Russia could have intervened. They have a base as well. It's the only country in the world that has a Russian and a U.S. military base in the same country. And they could have intervened and right away put themselves in the middle between these ethnically Kyrgyz Kyrgyzstani security forces and the ethnically Uzbek Kyrgyzstani civilians, put themselves in between, prevented a refugee crisis, prevented killings from happening, and they didn't do that. And they could have done this through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. They could have done it through the Commonwealth of Independent States, which is the CIS, which was created out of the former Soviet Union when all the non-Baltic states and stuff all agreed, you know, along with Russia in the early 1990s, that there was still some value to working together within an international, you know, some sort of supranational organization. They could have done it through that, and they didn't do that. And it's probably not because they didn't want to or whatever. It's probably a large factor of, did they have the capacity to do so? Probably not. There are situations where Russia could be doing things in the way that Britain does, and they choose not to. And it is fairly analogous. Sierra Leone was a, you know, former thing set up by the British as a, you know, former slaves colony, kind of like Liberia for the United States, right next door. Russia could have intervened in these former Soviet areas where a lot of the conflicts are a result of the fact that there has been previously Russian dominance under the Soviet Union and the Russian Empire. They could intervene in these situations. They could help. And in the ones where they do, they're not being helpful. And in the ones where they don't, they're just not doing anything. And to my mind, I don't understand what the argument here is about the Russians being somehow more influential than the United Kingdom. That's just not the case. The United Kingdom is still doing stuff. I don't see what Russia has done to positively contribute to anything in the world in the past 10 years.
Yeah, and also, I mean, when you look at, I mean, you mentioned the sort of previous colonial relationship that the UK has had, when you consider, I mean, obviously this is not impacting the world in a positive way, this, you know, the colonialism aspect, but it's, I think it's fair to say that that British culture, and even to some extent a British identity, has lasted longer in some British colonies than any sense of Russian identity has lasted in the Soviet satellites, the former Soviet satellites. I mean, I think that, you know, the culture of the UK, for better or for worse, has really lasted in a lot of areas that it has once occupied.
Right. And there's, you know, as you alluded to, there are downsides to that, you know, cultural imperialism and all that associated with the imperial period. But some of those influences are positive in the sense of, yeah, it's bad that it happened, but let's, you know, try to make the best out of the situation after the fact and say, look, Britain and France, to some extent, too, you have a responsibility to these former colonies to try to help broker agreements. You know, these can be military interventions or, more helpfully, even diplomatic interventions. Sometimes it's just, you know, an outside broker that everyone agrees isn't going to be, you know, that has a familiarity with the situation but doesn't necessarily side partially with one or the other, right? So, you know, that's something that Britain is doing in these areas. And then you were also mentioning, when you were talking about that article, that Britain, you know, David Cameron making the argument, and it seems kind of weak, and I can see why Russia wouldn't count it for much, but this argument, oh, we're going to be the ones, you know, making the case for condemning and punishing chemical weapons attacks, that he's going to continue to lead that diplomatic charge, even if the military option is off the table for the UK because of the parliamentary vote. And it's not nothing. I mean, you know, sometimes, and I'm sure, you know, the United States has this as well, and I'm sure it's the same case in Russia, these big military macho political cultures thinking that the only way you get something done is by blowing stuff up. And that, to me, that's, you know, that overstates the impact and power of the military on these situations, and it underemphasizes the need for diplomatic solutions and, you know, international norms and rallying the world. I mean, if you ignore the fact that, you know, if you ignore the diplomatic side and the talking aspect of this because it's just talking and not blowing stuff up, you're ignoring the fact that this is an international norm, and an international norm by its very nature is just a convention that people have kind of like agreed to, either formally on paper in this case or by, you know, informally agreeing to these things by what? Talking, not by bombing each other. So, you know, a lot of times I feel like we don't emphasize enough the potential power that can be made by being this person who can broker these situations. That's why, you know, you get Sweden or Switzerland working on various conflict resolution situations in a non-military capacity. And I think this actually bridges well into another topic that we wanted to talk about regarding climate change and kind of working on that. That's another thing where you know, that's not going to be solved by bombing anything. That's going to be solved by countries coming together, making the case to each other for why they all have to agree to something and getting it done. And in some respects, that's been really disappointing in the last few years, how little progress has been made, or even in the last 20 years. But you go back further than that, 1987, Montreal Protocol, that is one of the most successful international agreements of all time on any issue. 197 countries, every member of the United Nations, plus some other observer members and other, you know, entities that aren't full UN members, all agreed in 1987, look, we've got an ozone hole problem. Chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs in aerosols, air conditioners, coolant things, these various systems, these propellants and coolants are tearing a hole in the ozone and preventing them from having an ozone layer that protects our southern cap from and parts of Australia from severe sun damage and warming. And he said, look, we got to do something about this. We got to replace these chemicals. And, you know, I'm sure that at the time there was probably some complaints. Oh, we can't do that. The economic impact is going to be so hard. But, some countries of the world made the case to other countries. Look, we got to do this. We've all got to work together. All these countries agreed to it. All these countries executed it. CFCs have gone down dramatically. Some of these chemicals are still gradually, you know, the residual things left over, like fire extinguishers still have some chemicals that are being released periodically because you don't use them that often. So those are still going up gradually. But the CFCs, the biggest ones, those have been replaced. Then a few years later, we all got together again after, you know, making serious progress on CFCs and said, wait a minute, HCFCs, the replacement for that, is not as bad, but also has an impact. Let's get rid of that. 197 countries work together to get rid of that. I mean, you know, when you hear people saying like, oh, the United Nations doesn't do anything or whatever, that was a UN-led treaty. It's organized through the auspices of the UN. That treaty is filed through the United Nations. How are you going to pretend that we didn't accomplish something? That's huge. Getting all those countries to work together to get rid of these coolants and chemicals, that's a really big deal, because the ozone layer started closing back up that hole and repairing itself and getting rid of that problem. Now we're working on, you know, seeing what can we do beyond that, and that's where the more current news comes up. A few years ago, they said, now wait a minute, we replaced CFCs with HCFCs. Then we replaced HCFCs with HFCs, which are hydrofluorocarbons. It's a man-made compound. You don't find it in nature. And we say, look, that's a new coolant thing we're going to be able to use, and that's going to be fine. That's not going to cause ozone damage. But, you know, and that was very important in the sense of creating, you know, solving the ozone problem temporarily. But as can sometimes happen, you can't predict necessarily the effect that some of these things are going to have. Turns out it has a climate change effect. And molecule for molecule, and of course, there's a lot less of HCFCs compared to carbon dioxide output from, you know, world industry, developing nations, agriculture, you know, industrial scale agriculture, things like that. You know, there's a lot less of HFCs being put out. But on a molecule for molecule basis, it's something like 1,000 times more greenhouse gas affecting than or greenhouse effect inducing than carbon dioxide. So that is a really serious issue. And again, it wasn't an issue for a while. But then, as we've seen in the last 20 years alone, 1 billion people have been lifted out of poverty and into the middle class. And the majority of that has taken place, the vast, vast majority of that has taken place in the developing nations. In your Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, you know, to some extent, Turkey still in that category, Mexico, things like that. And these folks, you know, they get their refrigerators, they get their air conditioners, they get their basic luxuries that are, you know, that are middle class status items. And you get in China and India in particular, just huge numbers of the populations moving into these big cities, which are hotter than other areas, on top of the fact that the climate's been warming. And these people are installing air conditioners in every apartment or whatever. That, if they're using HCFCs, that affects the ozone layer. Fortunately, we've phased out most of that. We've got these newer units that are using HFCs. That has a climate effect, though. So a few years back, they said, hey, let's get together and add HFCs to the banned list and make a further amendment to the Montreal Protocol, get our acts together, replace it with something else. I looked up to see if there had actually been a replacement yet. And in fact, according to the EPA, they've already approved 3 alternative refrigerants as of 2011 for replacement in both commercial contexts, like big, huge industrial freezers and stuff, as well as household freezers and, you know, various other things. I'm sure ACs are in that category as well. They're not really anything exciting to talk about because they're known by like really obscure compound name. Not even like HFCs, that at least tells you what the chemical makeup is, but I don't know what R441A means. I mean, that's just probably some designation that they came up with to identify this generic thing. But we already have these. So it's not even an issue of like, oh, we got to rush to find a replacement after a treaty is amended. No, we've got the replacements. We just need to start manufacturing them, phase out the other stuff, phase in the new stuff, replace that in various air conditioners and freezer units, and we're good to go. So that's the situation. A few years ago, they said, let's get together and do that. A lot of countries were kind of not very on board with this. India in particular was kind of concerned about the impact that this would have. They've got a lot of those air conditioners that are going to be affected. And, you know, we said, look, we're going to really keep pushing for it. In this case, the United States has been one of the big groups, big countries pushing for it. I'm sure the UK has been in there as well on that. And that's, as I said, this is an example of where, you know, the talking stuff is kind of important. Right? Like if you don't push for this stuff, it doesn't get done. Somebody's got to make the case for it, say why it's important, because really, as we've found so evidently by this climate change discussion, you can't just present the scientific facts and say, look, obviously we got to do something. Let's leave it at that. No, you got to make the case for it. You got to explain why it's important. You got to explain how it's going to help. You got to explain why it's not going to be as bad as some of the critics are saying it's going to be. And in many cases, these things, as we've talked about so many times on the show, are nowhere near as bad as the critics insist that it's going to be beforehand. In fact, you often get benefits. The economic impacts of the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, which is just the U.S. only, that, you know, banning various compounds that are harmful, cause acid rain and things like that. They can cause health effects. They can cause mass environmental damage and farm damage and things like that. That's a pretty serious consequence, and we've solved that and caused a net economic benefit, especially by creating jobs of putting on, you know, building, manufacturing, installing all these scrubbers on these coal-fired power plants and things like that. That creates jobs. Net economic impact from that, according to the analyses that I've seen, and people thought this was going to just destroy U.S. industry and the power sector in particular because it was going to affect so many of these coal-fired power plants. And ultimately, that's been a positive change. I'm sure that this is going to be a positive change as well. Think about all the jobs that are going to be created by the guys who have to go around and replace all the coolants and all the air conditioners and every single window in Beijing and New Delhi. Yeah, there's going to be some economic impact, but then those guys now have jobs and they can spend money and so on and so forth. I think that on balance, it's going to be a positive thing, and everyone's going to be healthier, and there's going to be less climate impact. How much less of a climate impact? According to the estimates that we've been seeing, John Podesta, chair of the Center for American Progress, is quoted in the Center for American Progress's Think Progress in an article by Joanna Foster and Rebecca Lefton on September 6th. Podesta, formerly a White House guy, he says that the equivalent greenhouse effect that would be mitigated and reduced would be 90 billion tons of carbon dioxide by 2050, which isn't actually, as I said, a lot in terms of carbon dioxide. That's only 2 years worth, but it is a tremendous amount because the overall proportion of HFCs is pretty small compared to the impact of carbon dioxide in terms of the overall effect, but in terms of molecule for molecule basis, like we talked about earlier, way bigger impact. And the important thing to remember too is that even though it's a short-term impact, if it's much higher and it happens now, we could be hitting that tipping point if we haven't already. This is a way of eliminating that tipping point, or at least pushing it significantly down the road. You know, this in the Think Progress article here says this could potentially keep the Earth from warming by as much as a half a degree Celsius. And generally, it's considered an agreement that if the Earth warms by 2 degrees Celsius, you know, over the next 100 years at least, then that is going to be, you know, a pretty serious impact that we can't walk away from. That either starts really runaway chains of self-reinforcing global warming, or it just causes really huge impacts on water supplies and crops, and starts creating water shortages and food shortages around the world that become a really serious problem for everyone. So if we can kind of push that tipping point off and cut that warming by a half a degree Celsius, we got to do that. It may not solve the problem, but we have to do it if we want to even try. It may last for 8 or 15 years or something in the atmosphere, which is a lot less than carbon dioxide. But if it's doing it now, it has a higher impact and it's much greater. Just like I have concerns about using natural gas because the leaking from that and the partial burning results in putting a huge amount of methane in the atmosphere. And even though that lasts a lot shorter time than carbon dioxide, it's 22 times more effective at warming the planet than carbon dioxide. And it's happening now. And when you're talking about tipping points, it really does matter whether something is happening now versus later.
A half degree Celsius is 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit. And yeah, I think this is a really inspiring thing. I mean, all these countries getting together and at least, you know, agreeing on this. We were talking about all this depressing stuff with Syria, but here is an example of countries working together and not just insulting each other.
Right. And, you know, it's taken a couple years, but like I said, sometimes you got to make the case. You got to say, look, this is, you know, according to the Think Progress article, HFC-134A, which is one of the specific compounds. Again, these are come up with by chemical companies. They're not naturally occurring in nature. That's 1,430 times more damaging, you know, on a per molecule basis than a molecule of carbon dioxide. You can say, look, it's a relatively limited impact relative to, say, doing something serious about carbon dioxide, but if it's going to have a half degree one way or the other effect, that's a big thing. And it's something really small and targeted that we can tackle. It's not a question of, you know, putting a huge carbon cap on all industry and all farm sectors. This is something really concrete that says, look, stop putting it in air conditioning units and refrigerators. We have replacements that don't have that impact. And sure, it's probably going to create some other problem down the line, but we'll work on that as well later, because we've done this before and we can do it again. This has been a triumph of international cooperation. We can get together and do this again. So at the G20, they made a lot of progress this week on getting closer to at least working on amendments to this agreement. They've got a lot more. I think like 90 countries or so are on board, as opposed to maybe 50 or so that were on board just a few years ago. This is a really great example of working together. And again, somebody's got to make that case.
Yeah, and you know, if we can apply these strategies that we're seeing here, the thing about climate change that's so compelling on this international level is that it really is something that affects everyone. A lot of countries aren't necessarily willing to think in the long term, so that has been a barrier in the past. Really, it's in the interest of every country to cut back on their carbon footprint and to work towards lessening the impacts of climate change. And I think if we can apply this philosophy to sort of broader issues and other issues, and hopefully use these strategies in the future, that would be a really wonderful thing for international relations.
Well, I definitely agree with all that. It's been frustrating seeing some of the stalling and inaction on some of these issues, as you said, like Syria, in recent years, but that doesn't make me give up on the hope for international cooperation. There's a lot that can still be done, and even if it seems like it's minor, it can have a huge impact. We still have an ozone layer because of this agreement, and honestly, we really came very close to losing it entirely and having some pretty serious impact, but we all got together and fixed this problem. And that at least gives us hope that it's possible to get something done on some other issues. And in my opinion, if on balance you're going to get some of that, something done that helps people, then it's worth it to at least have that option available. Arsenal for Democracy from BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio. We'll be back in just a few moments with me and my co-host Persephone. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio still is Persephone. And we're going to talk first about a topic that we have often talked about on the show, but haven't talked about for several weeks. So you can brace yourselves. We are, of course, talking about, once again, the abortion debate in the United States. So Tara Culp Ressler on September 6th, 2013, published an article at Think Progress. And the headline was that was Forget About the Halls of Congress. The fight for abortion rights is coming to your backyard. And basically I thought, hey, this is going to be, this is going to be about locally fighting it for the people who want to fight it that we don't support on this show. And I figured, hey, this is going to be about zoning regulations. And a little bit of it was, but turns out there's a twist. And that twist is that local areas, not states, local cities are having ballot initiatives and ordinances passed by their city councils to restrict abortions within those city limits, which is the most absurd thing I have ever heard thus far in the entire debate on abortion rights in the post-Roe v. Wade, post-KCV Planned Parenthood discussion. I do not understand how it makes any sense whatsoever that a local city or county or whatever at a sub-state level could vote one way or the other on abortion rights. That seems absurd to me. I understand that they have the power to do zoning regulations, which is one thing that the anti-choice activists have been working on, is trying to get areas rezoned to prevent abortion clinics from being in certain areas and, you know, make it harder for them and force them to shut down. But this is flat out 20-week bans and things like that that we've been seeing at these broader state levels. The example here, for example, city of Albuquerque was having a vote in New Mexico. And it's, again, this isn't a New Mexico-wide thing. Now, I don't know. Maybe this is just an issue of New Mexico not understanding how to run its state government anymore on a consistent basis that applies laws across the state, as has recently been seen by the fact that a majority of the populations are now able to get same-sex marriages because those counties arbitrarily decided to start issuing them because there was no law in the books one way or the other. And then the state government so far hasn't figured out what to do about that. So there's just kind of an imbalance there. So, maybe this is an exception. But according to this article, this is not an exception limited to just New Mexico. This is just a situation where cities and towns are taking it into their own hands and putting abortion restrictions in place. Now, I'm sure the flip side of this will probably be that someplace like Cambridge, Massachusetts or something will put in some, you know, total opposite directional thing of, you know, that they affirm the right, free and legal and perfectly accessible at all times, like a 24-hour gas station. But I think that this is a truly absurd way of handling this discussion. I think it's bad enough that the states are going off and doing their own things. I think it should be consistently applied. But I think it's incredibly absurd to be saying that individual cities and towns and counties and other jurisdictions can be coming up with these. I mean, how does that even work? Persephone, give me your thoughts on this situation.
Well, I'm not really sure. I mean, I don't think that anybody has ever dealt with the issues of whether towns can handle this kind of thing before. I mean, it seems very, it's ingenious in a way. I mean,
You got to give them credit. The opposition is very clever at coming up with totally devious and totally ridiculous ways of fighting this issue that they passionately feel they've got to fight at every single cost. And I'm sure they're looking at other examples like these cities and towns voting down Citizens United and stuff, but those are resolutions advising the U.S. to do something on a national basis. This is different. This is saying, and this isn't even zoning things. Like, I thought, oh, they probably would say, like, no hospitals within the city limits can perform an abortion, or you can't have an abortion clinic anywhere because we've zoned against it or something. And that, I accept that they have the right to do that, even if I don't think that they should. They have the right to make annoying regulations like that. But I don't understand where they think that they derive the right to restrict not access, but the actual right to an abortion within their city limits.
I think another question I have that it wasn't really addressed in the article so much was how big of an impact this is going to have on individuals in different places. Because one of the big issues that the pro-choice community has faced is that something like, you know, 80 or 90% of counties in the United States don't have access to abortion providers. So are these laws being passed predominantly in places that already don't have any abortion providers? I mean, even if that is how it's working, obviously the consequences are going to be very long term. It's going to turn into something, if these laws hold up, where even if in 40 years abortion access is much more widespread, those places will still have these bans. But I am wondering whether this is something that actually is having a widespread impact on places that do have abortion providers and are now having to close down.
Well, here's the thing what I think is behind this strategy. I don't know that they necessarily believe that they're going to have an effect, that this is going to work, that these bans are going to work, because it sounds really super unconstitutional to me. However, right now, if they pass something in, say, North Dakota or South Dakota a few years back, you say, you know, they ban it outright, or they put some really intense restriction on, like the 6-week ban in North Dakota that was passed earlier this year. Now, every group in the country and all the statewide groups have an incentive, the pro-choice groups have an incentive to fight that all the way to the Supreme Court because they're representing the entire state. Now, North Dakota is not that big, but like if you think about it on a bigger state, if some big state, like if Texas, which, you know, it's certainly been discussed, and I think it actually maybe did get passed, they're now representing all of Texas, the second most populous state in the country. That's a, you know, that's a consolidation of resources. But, you know, go back to the old classic divide and conquer strategy. If you say, well, we're not banning this in all of New Mexico, we're just going to ban it in Albuquerque, assuming that this passes, which I don't know if it will, and hopefully it won't. Now you say, look, you're not representing a case. First of all, you have to find a test subject who definitely lives within the city limits, and you now have to represent in court Albuquerque. And now say another, now say Santa Fe also passes something like that, or you know, some other city in New Mexico passes that. Now you've got three cases as the pro-choice group that you've got to advocate for, and you can't consolidate them in a way that you could consolidate cases that are like, you could consolidate all of the gay marriage cases in California because it's for the whole state of California. But if you're dealing with an abortion case in three different jurisdictions with probably slightly different laws, you cannot combine those cases. I mean, maybe you can make a constitutional argument. Look, we're going to combine all these cases because they're all unconstitutional. But that is a very risky strategy because they could just throw it out of court and say, look, these are different cases because this one's a 20-week ban. This one's a 25-week ban. This one's a 19-week ban, something like that. Now you can't roll those together. So they're going to have to be fighting this in court at every single possible level, which ties up everyone's time, resources, money, everything, activists, so on and so forth. And that is what I assume here is the strategy behind this. And, you know, because they've figured out that if they can't get something done outright, they just do stalling actions and drag it through court, etc.
And the other thing I think is which is related, I think, to this issue, it's a lot easier to get something passed in a town than to contest it. And part of that is probably because of the sort of breakdown of people in a small town. You know, if you have, if you're talking statewide, you're invariably going to have a significant quantity of people who are pro-choice and who will be writing to legislators and writing to their representatives and emphasizing their feelings. You know, there will also be a number of people on the other side who are doing the same thing, but at least you have that volume, you know, you have that amount. But in one of these towns, it's entirely possible that there will be just like one or two people that use abortion services or will need abortion services that won't have access to it, and the entire town will be against them.
Or at the very least, not even against them, but this is potentially a more, even more serious argument, is not caring. Just a total apathy because it doesn't affect them personally, and they may not even be aware that it's happening because the turnout rates for local elections and local ballot initiatives are astronomically low in the average cities and towns in the United States. Even in a big city, not like a really big city like New York City, where I'm assuming a pretty significant population goes to the polls in an off-year 2013 citywide election. We'll see in a few weeks, I guess, if that's actually the case. But I would assume that at least there's a fairly significant chunk of people voting, probably significantly less than presidential level turnout, but still, it's going to be a significant chunk. But if you start getting down at any levels below that, so let's go a little bit outside of New York. Let's go to one of these more conservative or at least centrist areas of a little bit further out, upstate New York, not way upstate, but somewhat out there in the, you know, slightly more rural areas past the suburbs, or even a more conservative leaning suburb. Even if people don't care that much, you're now asking them to get to the vote, get to the polls for an unusual election, or pay attention to how their town selectmen or city councilors are voting on a thing that they probably aren't paying attention to. They can get all riled up about a stop sign placement or something, but they may not be completely paying attention to, you know, these abortion restrictions. And you'd think, oh, that's crazy, but I can easily see that happening. People, it either doesn't affect them, or they don't realize that it's happening, or it's never even crossed their mind because they know that the local jurisdiction handles stop signs and parking lines and things like that, but they never are going to think, oh, I wonder if my town is going to ban abortion rights, because that's insane. So that they, you know, even if you don't have like a groundswell of opposition, you can even have in like, I would guess, a fairly liberal leaning, you know, low to mid-sized city in the American Southwest or the Mountain West or something like that, you can have something go through with almost no one noticing because people aren't paying attention, that much attention. But the people who are paying attention are the single issue anti-choice fanatics. They are always paying attention and always mobilizing on that issue.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's not something that I would ever want to bring up. You know, I think it's more of a New England thing, but these town meetings that are open to everybody, you know, and are fairly transparent, like, I cannot really picture a situation where I would go into a town meeting and have a discussion with everybody in my town about abortion rights. I mean, if it happened, I would be there, but
that's because you're braced for that and you like understand, you know, but the average pro-choice supporter who supports it but isn't an activist or anything – there's no way that they're going to put themselves into a situation where they're going to be, you know, even if they've never had an abortion or anything like that, and it's not even like, you know, they have to tell a personal story, they just want to say, hey, I support it. They're going to be screamed at by crazy people, you know, who are these single issue people. And in my opinion, you know, to be fair here, anybody who's single issue anything is kind of crazy. You know, whether they're from the right or the left or whatever, if you're single issue, that kind of gets really problematic fast. But you're going to have to deal with someone screaming at you about how you're a baby killer who's going to hell or whatever because you stood up in your town meeting and tried to express this. And, you know, there could be 50 people there, 200 people there, 15 people there, whatever. But a lot of people aren't going to want to deal with that. And they may wholeheartedly support the continued right to choose and have that be accessible and everything. But they're not going to want to put themselves in that situation where they have to make that argument. Also, like, how are you going to put this on a referendum campaign? And then, I mean, I guess they do it at the state level sometimes. But, like, seriously, like, that must be crazy having, like, yard signs pro or con on abortion rights for a local issue. I mean, you know, so like people get uncomfortable enough putting up their, you know, town council or city councilor's election sign in their yard. So why are they going to do that? And that just, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are pro-choice but aren't necessarily going to be all like militantly active about it for a whole range of reasons. It's not necessarily their fault or anything. And that creates an unfair dynamic. So we've got this divide and conquer strategy. We've got this strategy relying on apathy. We've got this strategy that, you know, just ties up everything. And we've got this strategy, like you said, of kind of continually cutting off and choking off the abortion access at the minimum, if not rights, in various parts of states, preventing people from getting the access that they need, you know, because they can't get to it. All right. Well, Persephone, thank you so much for joining me here on Arsenal for Democracy again. Maybe we'll have you do a long distance middle of the night guest host with me at some point. But it's been great having you all summer here in my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. And best of luck in your studies in Belgium.
Thank you so much. And it's been really wonderful being here.
That's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for September 8th, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts every week, usually on Sundays, and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in Delaware, or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin, and my co-host, Persephone. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.